Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi there, I'm Janet. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what is a podcast?
It's like the radio, but there's no music, and literally anyone can do one at any moment about any subject. And there's a billion of them.
Sounds great. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today, we're talking about Season 1, Episode 10, Chidi's Choice. To recap, both Eleanor and Tahani declare their love for Chidi and then spend the day together trying to avoid the cliches of rivalry in a love triangle. Michael tries to help Chidi make a romantic decision while they are preparing Eleanor's defense for Sean. Meanwhile, Jason and Janet decide to get married. It was directed by Linda Mendoza, and guest cast includes Tia Sirkar, Keston John, and Bamba John Bamba. My guests this week are writer of the episode, Demi Adejuibe, and William Jackson Harper, who plays Chidi on Agonye. Demi and Will, welcome. Everything is fine. That's from the show. Did you recognize it?
I've never seen the show.
Oh, wow. Okay. You're going to love it.
What show is this?
This is...
Babylon 5.
It's Babylon 5 colon Two Broke Girls.
Oh, okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seen that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the crossover no one asked for. Thank you so much for being here. Will, what do people want to know about Chidi when they meet you on the street?
About Chidi? Not so much about Chidi. They want to know if I'm actually a philosopher.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which I'm not. So, you know, I'm completely devoid of answers.
That's obviously an enormous compliment. They're saying you deliver this dense material in such a convincing fashion that obviously you must be the world's largest dork.
You must be, yeah. I mean, I exude dork. Regardless.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it's...
Think of who you're talking to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
I get it.
But yeah, but like, I get a lot of questions. Like, so, you know, you read a lot of these books. And I'm like, absolutely not. I read the articles online and keep it simple.
Tell me about that. We've heard from other cast members and such, like they brief you, right? The writer's room, and you've had some consultation with actual philosophy professors.
Yeah. I mean, I think the writers have more of the, like, consultation with the professors, and then... You know, I'll get the script and I'm like, oh, this is a word I do not know and a concept I'm wildly unfamiliar with. So let me just read the Cliff's Notes on this, so I at least can, you know, craft something logical on screen. But yeah, I mean, I think the writers distill all that down for us, so it's, you know, we can focus on playing some jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Demi, what about you? Did you have any background in philosophy prior to taking this job?
None whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
I remember when the show started, Mike had suggested a few different points for reference and asked us all to read No Exit, which was a French play that a lot of the story is sort of referencing.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, I was completely in the dark.
Speaking of in the dark, is that the reference to Flashlight? Wasn't there a reference to Flashlight? I was in a cave and you were my flashlight. Doesn't that happen somewhere?
Yeah, there's this analogy of, you know, people stuck in a cave and all they can see are the shadows dancing on the wall, but not knowing that there's an entrance to the cave and a whole world outside of that. I actually forget where that...
I think it's from Allegory of the Cave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who's
I feel like Plato? You know for sure
that Plato?
It's much older.
Yeah. It's not mine.
Not a French play.
Not a French play. And yeah, but yeah, that's that. I think that's where that joke came from, or that line came from.
And to get your take on this, we've talked to some of the rest of the cast about this, but what did you know and when did you know it? We've talked about the video of Kristen and Mike sharing with you the twist to season one. You knew that by the time you were filming this episode. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
And then, was that immediately shocking? What was that meeting like for you?
I thought we were getting fired. I thought that we were
for real.
I thought we were getting some bad news. It was like, okay, hey, you know, we're all going to have a meeting. You know, it's like, we're not getting renewed. You know, it was fun while it lasted.
For sure.
You guys are super sweet. Bye. You know, that's where I thought we were headed. And then that meeting was pretty mind blowing. I also was like, oh, good. You know, because there's like I did wonder how long this, the premise as presented to us when we were auditioning for the project, how long that could hold.
Right.
You know, and maintain any sort of, you know, tension. And so,
because in a sense there are stakes, but everything can be undone, and I suppose you weren't aware of the reboot concept in the way we think of it now, but you know, it's heaven and the afterlife and it's infinite, and you know, there can be sinkholes and then they can go away, kind of thing. So what are the stakes, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that it's like, oh, okay, well, now we're going into no exit land, which is like, you know, that's something, I mean, as a theater kid, that's one of those plays in high school that you read and feel, you know, real self-important and snobby about. And then, and so it was, yeah, it was like my little pretentious high school theater dork was just giddy when we got that news.
How much cheaty is there in you? Are you indecisive?
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah. Incredibly indecisive. I'm trying to be better about it. Because I'm like, oh, that makes everyone crazy. And I should not indulge that. So, I've tried to improve, but, I am pretty indecisive. He's way more vocal than I am though about his neuroses. It's like if I'm freaking out, I just kind of shut down and go into a weird little fugue state and walk off, you know, and mm-hmm. that's about the extent of it for me.
I'm having a funny memory of season one with you between takes, playing Scrabble with friends or whatever, some sort of app. And when you and I would pass it back and forth, we had to watch an ad each time in between because you hadn't committed yet to buying the app or whatever.
It was too many dollars.
Yeah.
It was too many.
I remember you
dollars.
Saying, old habits die hard.
Yeah, man. You know, I don't know how long I want to have this job. I can't be blowing money on words with friends.
This is an episode in which we see a little bit of Eleanor and her backstory. It's very subtle. It's very parenthetical. But she suggests, while she's, this is skipping ahead a little bit in the episode, but when she's putting hair extensions into Hani's hair, it's revealed that she got good at that because she had to be older at age 14 to get a job. So we have some of these endearing qualities about Eleanor that, you know, keep us from despising what is otherwise a fairly odious person. And I feel like we get so much of that in Chidi in this episode because, yes, he's maddeningly indecisive about stuff. And the kids' flashbacks are remarkable. Those children were fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
But so much, you know, his indecision is really well-based. I mean, he's considering the fragile egos of his classmates and the sexual implications of picking a girl versus not picking a girl in soccer. Talk a little bit about that. What went into framing, you know, a hateable but rootable backstory for Chidi?
I think the Chidi's indecision is something that everyone can sort of relate to, in that when you see it leads up to a certain consequence, it makes sense that someone would think of every single thing that they choose as like, well, this could have a butterfly effect that completely ruins this one thing. And just making Chidi the kind of person who's always concerned about that was something that Mike had planned from like the very beginning. And so when we were doing these scenes, we were just like, what is the funniest way to have that indecision play out in someone, even when they're super young? And just having it be something where it's like, there are obviously no stakes in who they pick.
Right.
But having Chidi be the person who adds those stakes was just funny because it was like, this is something that is not supposed to have any consequences, but giving it consequences and giving it, giving him the sort of resources to make these sweeping, like, oh, yeah, it might be sexist if I choose a girl and it might be unfun if I choose, like, my friend, was just a fun way to make Chidi, his whole personality a little bit younger. And so I think that it was just a very easy decision to make, but it was also, I don't know, it was mostly about trying to see what the weirdest thing we could do with someone of that age would be in getting that indecision across.
I love that he spends the entire recess filibustering.
Yeah.
Like, he basically can't even get there and the bell rings. And I don't know, you just really deeply sense that this is not the first time this has happened.
Absolutely.
To these poor kids on this playground.
But, you know, I mean, how long is a recess? A recess is like 20, 30 minutes, something like that.
Right.
And I'm wondering how many times, like, as a grown man, I'm like, okay, I'm going to order some food. An hour later, I've not done anything yet.
Right.
Yes.
It's like, you know, and I've watched two episodes of, like, I don't know, Who's the Boss? And then, like, that's what I've done instead of eating anything.
I do that in hotels for some reason. Like, I'll be, you know, at night in a hotel, if I'm away working, I'll go like, oh, I'm in a city, I should explore what's local and whatever. And without fail, I wind up ordering a terrible room service steak or something, just because it's, I don't know. I'm letting the perfect meal in Atlanta be the enemy of just eating dinner.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's about.
It feels like there's a buildup to making that big decision that you're just kind of, you let it pass too long and then you've just done something else.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you're like, my blood sugar's low.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're closing soon.
I need a handful of crackers.
So were you in the room, Demi, for throughout season one, like for the breaking of the arc of where these episodes were headed and how to step them out?
Yeah. So funny enough, I joined the room, I want to say 3 weeks after they had started it. And when I walked in, I didn't have much of a clue as to what the show was actually about.
Wow.
I was just kind of like, yeah, it's a Mike Schur show. I will do it. I don't need to know anything. I don't have questions.
Oh, that I understand completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I remember the first day I walked in and they were talking about the show and they had already been discussing like the characters and the arc. And I was just like, I have no idea what's going on. What do you mean they're dead? Or like, what do you mean? And like, so and Mike brought me into his room and was like, okay, I'm sure you're very confused. Let me explain. And he plotted out the entire season, was like, so yeah, and at the end of season one, this is what happens. And I was just like, this is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm in. but then it was just about breaking down what happens to get from point A to point B through the season. And so we broke out like the different points of the season into like what things would happen and what would change. And then getting to this episode was fun because it was sort of like building up to the natural conclusion of like, oh yeah, Eleanor is going to think she's with Jean Yu because these are the two people that weren't supposed to be here. And then having that twist of like, no.
Right.
It was very fun. And it was really fun to be a part of that little mini twist.
That was a great misdirect, I think, because I mean, first of all, I don't know anybody who's ever sold a realization more strongly than Kristen Bell. Like when she goes, hang on a second, like, uh-oh, that may be. And that connection between Jianyu or Jason and Eleanor, you're like, oh, that actually super fits.
Right.
Like those two obviously would be soulmates. I forget what she, like, he's a dumb bro.
He's a hot dummy.
Hot dummy. Yeah. Straight up in my wheelhouse or whatever. This is the first episode, I think, where one of the humans uses the word torture. Like that had to be a little bit of a, at one point Eleanor says, I think to Bomba John and to real Eleanor, later Vicky, I saw them, you know, I saw Chidi being tortured by guilt. And like, that's the, looking at it now, looking at it with episode 113 and the big twist, you go, ooh, that kind of gets you close. Like, I'm surprised that, you know, I didn't sniff that there may be some of, you know, that it may not be, in fact, the good place. You guys, we've talked with other writers as well that said, like, you tried to get close to it. You tried to, you know, stave off that until the episode 113, but also surprise us here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, that word torture stuck out in the rewatching of this like crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many things in rewatching it that sort of make you go like, oh, yeah, we should have had a hint of it a lot. I remember there was a video that was of Mike talking at a panel before the show came out, and he made a joke that like, yeah, the entire place is hell, and no one caught it. And
wow.
I saved that video until like the day it premiered, and then I was like tweeting just like, so this happened, and I was just, it was so fun to watch that and be like, oh, no one believed him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. I can't believe that. It is a joke. Although I'm terrified about anything. At the time of this recording, season three is being shot, and I'm horrified to joke about anything. I was on Twitter the other day, and a friend said, you know, jokingly said, don't tell me anything about The Good Place. I'm not caught up or something. And I said, spoiler, I'm Ted Danson. And I was like, oh, as soon as I pressed send on, I was like, oh, I should not joke in this direction at all. Like, sure. I don't know where things are headed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, yeah. I'm expecting to get a call from Mike going like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
A, how did you know? And B, what are you doing? Spoiler alert, I'm not Ted Danson. He's a totally different guy.
As far as you know.
I'm not up to it. Hilariously, later in the episode, Jason shows a picture of one of his idols. He reveals that Chidi had the painting made of Tahani as ballerina. But he shows a photo or a painting of Frank Caliendo. Yeah. Why Frank Caliendo? Did you ask Frank Caliendo? Did you had to pay Frank Caliendo?
I am not entirely sure what the deal with, like, whether or not they had to get the rights to that. But I think that was just a joke that Joe Mandy was obsessed with Frank Caliendo being the person that John you love, just because he was like, he thought of him as an impressionist, as in a person who does impressions.
Right.
And then from there, Joe Manny just ran wild with Frank Caliendo as the person.
Oh, no.
I remember outside of my office, there was a mock-up painting that the like people who do sort of the props on the show had made of Frank Caliendo. And it was just hanging there for so long before they got the final painting done. And it was the funniest thing. But yeah. It was just based out of the joke of impressionist being a word for a person who does impressions.
I would, I'll admit, I did not even get that connection between an impressionist painting and someone who does impressions. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And is very Joe Mandy. Was anybody else ever considered, or was it,
I don't remember anyone else being considered, but I really do think it was just like Joe Mandy said Frank Caliendo and everyone's like, yeah, that's it.
Will, this episode is called Chidi's Choice, and this is he's having to answer for who he sees as his soulmate, who he wants to do it. But your character made a big decision a couple of episodes before this in Most Improved Player when he confessed to Michael that he was the one that murdered Janet. Do you get stomach aches in real life?
Yes. Yeah. I'm pretty anxious, so I spend a lot of time. Spend a lot of time in gastrointestinal distress.
Hey, great. But, please describe.
Yeah. Well, it's bubbles. there comes a point where anyone with that sort of strict moral code, you're not going to be able to keep up the facade. Eventually, it's going to crack. And if it cracks later and you're not in charge of it, it's going to be a bad scene. And, you know, and I think that that's sort of, you know, that's what this, you know, the whole admission was about. It's like, there's no way that Chidi was going to be able to keep this together, you know.
I sort of love that Michael, you know, again, looking, rewatching these episodes with the benefit of hindsight, Michael deliciously injects doubt later on to say like, oh, it may not be even either of these two Eleanors. Like, it could be any, like, if the system's broken, the system could be all the way broken. Did you guys in the room explore what that could mean?
Just what it means for the system to be broken?
Yeah, like how bad it could get. I mean, obviously, you know, we've had trash storms and giraffes and all sorts of things, but
I think we knew that every source of conflict for the season had to come from Michael, since he was the like arbiter behind all of it. But it really was sort of like, there were so many different ways that we went with certain ideas that I don't think ever made it. Like, there was an idea that they had like some sort of game night that went wrong on one episode, but it was all just like Michael was the source of all the chaos, but how that manifested in the neighborhood could have been anything. And it was very fun to just sort of think of different ways that he would sow doubt. And Chidi was one of the best ways to sow doubt, as someone who was just naturally conflicted in a lot of different ways. But I think that I don't think that we ever explored anything that was super crazy. It was always just sort of making it believable, but making it not seem like it was always coming from Michael, because
right,
that was part of the hiding the twist.
Well, I mean, it's hiding the twist in and that he would have to sort of present the information but go, it seems that it's this,
yeah,
or it must be that this, I don't know, things are falling, it's weird, did mm-hmm. anybody do anything? And as you say, like, Chidi's the perfect foil for that because he arrives guilty,
right,
having done nothing at all.
Yeah.
Last week, after we recorded a couple of these podcasts, I went with Lizzie, the writer's assistant, back to the writer's room, curious about how it worked, and saw Mike at the end of the hall, and he said, "Oh, hi, Mark," and turned to the room, which was in full session, like 14 people hanging out, and it was the most intimidated I've ever been in my entire life. It was as though Mike said, like, "Oh, hey, Mark, you know the X-Men," like just the smartest, funniest people on the planet all assembled in one room.
That room is super intimidating.
I mean, it's intimidating. Yes. I'm right about this, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I was every day on the show, I was intimidated. Because it's like, not only are these all brilliant people from like Parks and Rec, but they're all just comedians and brilliant people in their own right. And it's like, even if you didn't watch Parks and Rec, you'd be like, "Oh yeah, I know them from comedy," or, "Oh, I know them from their New Yorker pieces." "Oh, I know them from writing on this thing." And it's just like, everyone's brilliant. And then adding in the philosophical elements is just like,
that's okay. What I'm talking about.
Yeah. It feels like they are all, it's 15 Professor X's.
Right.
Yeah.
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 I remember one day me and Darcy walked in and we were, you know, they were just running through some of the stuff that's going to happen in the upcoming season. And, I remember they were pitching some ideas and we were there for it and we were just listening and felt like just so incredibly under-equipped to be there or to be, you know, like participating. And we're like, I mean, it's like, talking about my character. Should I say something? Nah, man, I'm too stupid for that. I'm just gonna wait it out. And then wound up just sitting silent and leaving and hopefully, you know, hoping that we didn't piss anybody off.
That's how
by
I felt.
Just being in the room.
Yeah.
It's like, are we messing up the vibe? Are we?
That's exactly what I felt.
You know,
I was in there thinking, I can feel who in this room is like, thank God a break. I'll get a cup of coffee. And then others that were like, I was about to deliver a genius idea. No, it was the most intimidating thing. And to be let in on a little bit of, you know, where things are headed or things they're considering. I mean, I find myself wanting to say to them, thank you for writing the line, I'm a naughty bitch. Thank you for writing the line, I took the form of a 45-year-old white man for a reason I can only fail up. And also simultaneously, almost like an older sibling, like looking at that room, knowing that they can see straight through my bullshit. You know, like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're funnier than I am. They're smarter than I am. It's an intimidating room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And to put, you know, to put people like that together with together and then assemble a show like this, I think you are the only folks that could do it.
It is so fun to be able to put together a show that has like these grand philosophical questions put into like a sitcom form, but then also throws in lines like, I'm a naughty bitch. And it's just like, are these the same people? And it's like, yeah, it is.
Right.
Somehow it is.
I have a line in the first season that I'll never forget because it has a fart joke and then meter. Like it's not pentameter, but it was... I rule the fart inadmissible as evidence. What is of concern is the recent development of Eleanor stealing my train. Like, that's different than other work I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Speaking of this episode, why don't we listen to a clip?
I'm sorry. You were right. This is too much for me. You should just leave me here and go get married.
Yeah. Here's the thing, bud. My wedding isn't for another month. This was a test to see if you could handle being my best man. And just as I predicted, you failed miserably.
Oh, no. No, I mean, I'm relieved, but this is embarrassing.
It's okay, bud. Obviously, I prepared for this. Let's just go have a nice night. I'll buy you a beer.
30 minutes, Chidi? We've been trying to pick a bar for 30 minutes. It is literally impossible to be your friend. You're incapable of making a single decision.
Look. I know I can be indecisive, but what's the harm in taking a few extra minutes to find the perfect... Chidi?
Oh, Chidi.
Mm.
What was it like shooting Chidi's death?
Oh, well, it was a lot of fun. I'll tell you why. There's our special effects guy, Virgil, was dropping a big green screen block out of a window onto my head, and I would look up every time that he was doing it, and he had the biggest shirt-eating grin on his face. He was just so happy to be dropping this thing on me. And you know, he was just like, is that okay? He's like this really deep voice. He was like, hey, you all right? And I'm like, I'm fine, you dick. You
know? Certainly the block approximated the weight and dimension of an actual air conditioner.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, but he was having a great time that day.
How many times do you think you did it?
We did it a solid, no, I'm gonna say a solid like 10 times or so, you know. Sometimes I would, you know, wouldn't be there, but then he really loved the ones where he got to just nail me with it and just drop it on my head. That was his jam.
I just think it's such an endearing thing about Chidi too, that his best friend in the world acquiesces, tries a dry run at having him be his best man, and has this elaborate scheme of like doing it a month early just to see if we can even get close, yeah. You know? I mean, that just seems really in the wheelhouse of that character.
Well, that's a buddy that, you know, obviously knows Chidi needs therapy and Chidi's not getting it. And so he's going to, you know, just be a pal, you know.
Did you get to keep the red boots?
I did not.
Oh.
I did not get to keep the red boots.
That should be the wrap gift for season 3.
That should be.
Everyone gets those same red boots and then you have to wear them.
Yeah, to the wrap party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't asked this of anyone before, but that raises a good question. What would be like one piece of the show that you would love to own? Would it be the red boots? Would it be the stripy pajamas?
Oh man. You know, actually I have, I have taken a pair of Chidi's loafers. I have taken them.
That's the most Chidi stolen.
I know.
That could not be more drab.
I know. But the rest of it is just not me. But and neither are the loafers. But for some reason, I'm really into them.
Will, that's like saying I took my leftover chicken home from lunch.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
It's terrible.
It's not cool.
It's pitiful. No, it's not. It's not at all.
I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like
and
it.
And I didn't even steal them. I asked, and they said yes.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, I didn't even steal them.
You're never using these again.
The fact that you're having to make that clear to the audience is super cheating. That is very cheating. Here's the list of stuff I would like to steal. I would like one of the Bad Place senior staff pins, the things that you guys took, the thumbs down lapel pins that got you through the portal. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah.
I may or may not have a torture report, one of the red files.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
When we shot the pilot, they had all of the clown paintings up, and I was just like, I really want to be like, where do these go when...
Want one of those in your house?
Oh, I'm not going to like hang it in my bedroom or something, but if I put it like by the door where I can only see it from like a certain angle, yeah.
The one thing that I thought about asking for from season 1, because I know they had a billion, was the book, What We Owe to Each Other, because when Eleanor writes, Eleanor Find Chidi, and tears out a page, like we shot that 1,000 times.
Right.
So they had ordered, I don't know, 40 copies of that book or something.
Yeah. Hmm.
And I thought it might be cool to have one of these. I'll get it on Amazon.
When we shot episode 110, the very next episode they were preparing for it, and they had all of the dress
bench
shirts.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I want one of these.
Oh my gosh, that's a brilliant thing. Yeah. I want a dress
bench
shirt.
Absolutely.
I super object to the use of the word
bench,
but I would like one of those shirts to hang in my office.
Just back to the clown paintings. There's nothing more frightening than a clown painting in a dimly lit room.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like in the pitch black, obviously you don't see it. And in, you know, a bright room, it's fine. But in a dimly lit room, like a clown portrait is absolutely terrifying.
It almost feels like the portrait was not there. And if you ask anyone about it, they'll be like, I don't know what you're talking about.
You can ask the portrait itself and it'll answer you.
Yeah. The portrait placed itself there in that dimly lit room.
I don't know if this has gotten a lot of play, but in Eleanor's house on the show, there is a sort of a disembodied clown, like a deconstructed.
Yeah.
Patches
apart. Yeah.
Like
I hate it.
And we've been in there when it's been dimly lit and it's legitimately creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like he was... This is all that's left of the clown apocalypse. Like, they existed. They were a civilization, a mighty, fierce...
warrior class.
Warrior class. And they were defeated. And this is all that we have left.
It's like the end of I Am Legend, but in a glass case.
It's really off-putting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have we ever seen... I know that when the doors have closed, we've seen the outside of Eleanor's bedroom... There are two clowns painted on the inside of those pocket doors, those sliding doors that meet each other. Have we ever seen that on the show? Oh, we have. Because when I read your book, when Sean said Chidi is a terrible writer.
Yeah. we had a meeting, like just the four dirtbag humans. That was Jason was getting slapped a lot. And I remember, there's like a couple of clowns. Not quite as creepy as the Pagliacci on the outside, but...
Those giant sliding doors. Anytime that they close and they've been open for a while, I just remember and go, ah, oh, yeah, no, don't like that.
Yeah.
That plus the sound effect is pretty great.
Yeah.
We got to see some of Jason's life in this episode, which is really fun. I love the way that the episode begins with him listing just numbers of this one's first and this one's last.
Yes.
It's fun to watch Tahani get to meet Jason, which is pretty terrible. What, in addition to things like stupid Nicks and ugly Nicks, meet Trench and things like that, like what other Jasonisms were considered? I'm asking because you said, Demi, that you have the luxury of, we can go back and watch the episode. Mm-hmm. You have the luxury of going back and reading your original draft.
Yeah.
Was that a long way from what we saw?
It was. That entire first scene, there are so many jokes that were changed from script to screen. The joke that opens the episode is a Fast and Furious listing, which is a very me joke, but I did not write it.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I have no idea who did, but the original draft of that joke was him talking about his process of Grand Theft Auto and how he can't play it anymore because he got soup in the controller. And it's so many, there are a lot of things like that that changed. There was a running joke based on a video that Joe Mandy, again, was obsessed with in the writer's room of a kid trying to punish himself after like going on a joyride and saying that he wasn't going to play his Xbox for an entire week. And then he like pauses between week and end just to be like, it's not that bad.
Right.
And that was how that the cold open was going to end, with Johnny just being like, no, hey, I'll let you borrow my Xbox for an entire week. Which I loved. And then there was a joke that got cut, and I fully agree with it being cut, but it was Tahani saying, you are just pretending to be a monk. You're no better than Tony Shalhoub. And then John Yu says, hey, I'm way better than Tony Shamu. So it was a lot of different things of him saying, or like Tahani saying one thing and then him completely misinterpreting it.
Yeah, it's studying ethnics and and bleach of contract, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
There is only one Jason Mendoza.
It's very fun to just write misheard things for Jason.
I love that you guys tooled up for a 2-second bit, an entire British sitcom of Deirdre and Margaret that ran for 16 years and nearly 30 episodes, which is a deep pocket BBC bit, which I love. I mean, things like that cost money, right? Like,
yes. So they had a set for Deirdre and Margaret, and they shot what is like a 30-second clip of it.
You shot a lot more than we've seen?
Yes. And there was talk in the writer's room of just writing a lot more of Deirdre and Margaret. So maybe that's something you'll see. But I loved that bit. And I'm so glad that it made it in, because it is, again, like a lot of work for a short bit.
It's a lot of work for a short bit, which I think is, I don't know. Mike has talked about, you know, wanting to exploit the world of The Good Place and have something crazy that couldn't happen on Earth.
Totally.
Happen. And that feels like a real world version of that, of like, oh no, we're totally going to build the set for a, you know, long running British sitcom kind of thing. I also liked, and I'm curious about this, that you sort of foreshadow something that happens in episode 113. The whole twist, the whole reveal of Eleanor realizing that she's been here before is predicated on Janet's not being able to eat. Mm-hmm. And you do that with the wedding cake here. Jason goes to feed Janet the wedding cake and ends up smearing it all over her face, which
you're
had to be a ball to shoot. So you're realizing that. So was that not kind of a like, here we're gonna hint this and exploit it later?
I don't think it was something that was written. I want to say that it might have worked the other way around, and that when writing 113, they realized that that was a tool. But I wasn't in the room while they were writing 113. Just like when we were blocking it out, I was. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get to see the final version of 113 until it aired. So now I'm just like, I wonder if. But they're such geniuses, that could have been something that they mentioned and I just completely missed or not.
It came up in an earlier episode, too, that that Janet just parenthetically says, well, I don't eat anything, so whatever. I don't know. It all comes back and you realize.
I fully believe that that was like a conscious decision, because I remember it happening on set, that it was just like a funny thing that they kept doing. And I wonder if they went back and were like, well, this is perfect. Now we can use this as a tool for the jumping into season 2. But yeah.
Very interesting. Has working on the show changed the way you view the world? Are you more or less points conscious than you were prior?
I'm not necessarily like points conscious, but I am just a little bit more invested in generally doing the right thing pretty much all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, I mean, not that I was like a complete dirtbag before, but I mean, I'm a little bit more invested in just like, oh, like this is a thing that drives people crazy, and I'm trying to get away with something here, and that's just being mean, or you know, or like we were talking about this as a group, as a cast, a little while ago, but it was like, you know, I'm like one of those guys that like at the Starbucks, I don't like for the barista to see that I'm tipping them, just because I'd rather just be like, oh, well, you know, I don't want the credit. I just want it to be, it's like, okay, a dollar magically appeared. You know, it's
right.
Like little stuff like that where it's like, it's not about like seeing, it's like the motivation is just like to do some good, but not necessarily to get any credit for it.
Right.
Totally. Yeah. I think that is something that I've definitely been more conscious of in just how I live now. But also I sometimes get these weird feelings of like just this sort of paranoia of like, huh, is this like how much of this is all constructed of like things that are happening around me? Sort of that Truman Show delusion that a lot of people have felt. And I know that it's crazy, but I also am just like, because of that, I'm going to everything I do, just sort of, you know, act or not act, but like try to do my best in being good. And I feel like it's a very crazy thought of like how much of this is really constructed and how much of it is just life. But it's working on a show that's based entirely around that idea has made it something that is like inescapable as a thought.
Yeah. And I would argue that it may not be that crazy. Like there are cameras everywhere. We all carry a camera and a microphone on our person at all times, it seems. And if the internet is any indication, like we're super under surveillance most of the time. And
yeah.
I'm not a giant conspiracy theorist, but like, I think it's good to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also don't want to just one day be like, oh, I'm a meme. And just like, well, yeah, you were walking around doing this weird thing with your hands and we all saw it. So it's a meme now.
I don't know. I think it's also like when given the choice to be like, you know, kind of a jerk to somebody or to be nice to them, it's just a much easier thing to just be nice to them.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just, it's just to be the, that's going to, being a jerk is going to cost, at least to me, it's going to cost me a lot more over the course of the day. I'm going to be like, I was a jerk. I know.
That hurts.
A jerk. Yeah.
Later,
I was like,
you're
I did that.
Oh. I'm a terrible person.
I'm a terrible person. Yeah. I shouldn't have done that, you know?
Yeah.
With that in mind, what's good?
What is good? What's been a driving force for me and making me feel good lately? I feel so many people have come on the show and said looser things, and I feel weird that I don't have something that's just like, oh, you know, a daffodil. I've been really enjoying the season of Killing Eve.
Oh, yes.
It's a great show. And a friend recommended it to me just on like an offhand recommendation. I was like, okay, I'll check it out.
And it's a show on BBC America.
Yes.
And another
binged,
network.
Like, yeah, bad, don't support it.
Sure.
But I binged like 5 episodes in one night, and I was like, this is a good show. I'm into it. So that's what's good.
I like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well...
I mean, a lot. So, you know, I got this dog who's dumb and so cute.
What is your dog's name?
Chico.
Chico.
Chico the dog. He's got an underbite and a floppy ear and he's patchy. And also, I have this little cousin who there's these videos of him that pop up every now and again, of him singing in church or just screaming into a microphone in his house, which that's pretty great.
How old is he?
He is
37.
He's yeah. He's just smaller than me. Same age, just a little bit smaller. No, he's 2.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yeah.
Demi Adijuibe, William Jackson Harper, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having
us.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Go do something good.
there. The podcast is over. I think what I'm feeling is sadness.
Oh, don't worry, Janet. This podcast is the most perfectly engineered invention since the paperclip.
Fun fact, the man who invented the paperclip is in The Bad Place for tax evasion.
It's available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop saying podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
Music composed by David Schwartz. Yay.